طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not find this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. For the most part, reviewing 2021 is a painful process. For Palestinians, review of every year is a painful process, and in 2021, it was no exception. But that is exactly what we will do this morning on This Week in Palestine, review 2021 through the Palestinian narrative. In today's feature presentation, the Foundation for Middle East Peace's President Laura Friedman hosts Palestinian organizer and activist Fadi Kuran and journalist and professor Peter Beinart for a wide-ranging conversation about 2021's most defining events when it comes to the lived reality of Palestinians and Israelis on the ground, as well as U.S. politics on the issue. The trio also gives their predictions for what might unfold in 2022. It begins with Laura Friedman.
Just as a way of starting us off, it's obviously been a busy year, and a big year, right? We have a new administration in the United States, new government in Israel. We had a summer surge in violence in the Holy Land. We had violence in Jerusalem, Gaza, inside 48 Israel, culminating in the emergence of what some are calling the Unity Intifada, with Palestinians rising up on both sides of the Green Line, including you, Fadi, and people like you, Fadi, mobilizing publicly against the repression of the Palestinian Authority. We've also seen a rise in state-backed violence. We've been seeing that right now, and really just so much more. So Fadi, why don't we start with you? I was gonna say, you know, give me your top 10 list, but that's silly. So maybe just if you wanna talk about a couple things that for you stand out as the most important developments of the past year, and then Peter, jump in, as you know, as Fadi's going, or I'd think about what you want to say next, and then I'll offer my own thoughts as well.
Thank you, Laura, and it's good to be with you and Peter as this year ends. And I think next year, and I think we'll get to next year in a little bit, but I'm very excited about next year, because what we're seeing, what we saw in 2021, I think were three kind of core moments. So starting at the very local level, I think event number one is Sheikh Jarrah and the Palestinian coordination that happened across, historical Palestine, whether it was the strike on May 18th, which all Palestinians participated in, or whether it was the kind of continued protests that happened. And I think that's one important, very momentous shift in terms of Palestinian organizing. The second thing I would say on the international level that was pivotal this year was the recognition by Human Rights Watch, and then Beit Salem, and then a number of other influencers, opinion leaders, academics, that you know Israel's committing the crime of apartheid. And I think this is, when we look back at 2021, this is going to be another watershed moment that people remember. And then the third piece from a kind of Palestinian context that was just huge this year is the Palestinian Authority's assassination of Nizar Banat, but really the response to that, where I think at no point, and even PA officials have stated this, have they felt a complete loss in legitimacy. And whether that includes kind of them canceling elections, whether that includes increasing repression, the core piece here is that the Palestinian Authority does not have any legitimacy to claim that it represents the Palestinian people, apart from its iron grip. So those are what I would say the top three. Of course, what I would add on the Israeli side, which you already mentioned, is the elections and kind of Netanyahu disappearing from power. But I think from a Palestinian perspective, honestly, although that seems like a big shift, our experience of the occupation hasn't really changed much. And I'll hand over to you. I'd love to hear what both of you kind of have to say.
All right, Peter, you're up next.
Let me just talk. I'll just talk a little bit of maybe just about the U.S. because I don't know things on the ground like Fadi does. I just try to learn from him and others who are on the ground. I think when I think about the United States, I think one way of thinking about what's happened this year, and I think will continue to happen, which is really significant, is, and I think encouraging, is I think we are moving towards a more genuinely Jewish and Palestinian movement in the United States, Jewish, Palestinian, and more and broadly. I mean, if you think about this moment, you have the BDS movement starting in 2005, which represents a kind of a new moment in Palestinian solidarity circles. And then you have you have J Street starting in 2009. And these are really working on very parallel tracks with totally different visions. J Street is a Jewish movement. And then If Not Now, basically If Not Now, a little bit less, but liberal Zionist within a two-state framework. The BDS movement is challenging that framework and led by Palestinians, bringing in others. And I think what's happening is that the boundaries between these two movements are starting to collapse. But you know, or another way, even more provocative way you could say it is the Palestinian solidarity movement is in some ways becoming broader and taking in, I would say. It's not necessarily a kind of equal marriage, I would say, because movement on the ground has made the two-state solution and the idea of liberal Zionism harder and harder and harder to maintain, that I think ultimately what's happening is you're ultimately what we have to move towards. And I think what is happening is a broader Palestinian solidarity movement that in which people who used to be liberal Zionists or support two states and more people inside the Jewish community and others find their way into and find point. Now, it's not an easy set of relationships always. And I think it involves lots and lots of different kinds of conversations and things that are difficult to figure out in a lot of ways. And you don't see it necessarily manifested in Washington, where you know, a group like J Street is still much, much more influential than the Palestinian solidarity groups. But if you think of where the momentum is coming, and I think especially because the Black Lives Matter movement forced a new kind of reckoning in the American public square with the lack of representation from Palestinians, which I don't think is going to end. So Palestinians, I think, are going to become more prominent in these conversations. And as Palestinians become more prominent, I think we will see a broader Palestinian solidarity movement in which Jews, including Jews who used to be considered themselves liberal Zionists, and maybe even still some who do consider themselves liberal Zionists, will find a place. And I think that will ultimately be a more powerful opposition to the status quo than what we've had before. I would love to see it replicated inside Israel-Palestine as well, you know, within which you might see Meretz joining into a broader joint list. It seems to me that seems to me the vision that one needs more generally, in which you bring together a kind of broad movement to fight against the kind of hyper ethno-nationalism and racism that we see represented by both the Israeli government and many of its supporters in the US.
Thanks. I love that you both start off with actually sort of optimistic things, because I was thinking about this and my first thoughts were not so much optimistic, but more, you know, reality check. You know, for me, part of this year has been about sort of the end of even the hope that a Biden administration was going to somehow lead us to a breakthrough in Israeli-Palestinian peace, which I think a lot of us who work on these issues closely, we're always deeply skeptical about. You don't want to completely foreclose the possibility of hope, but it was always something to be skeptical about. And their performance thus far would suggest that there's really no energy there. I mean, if the energy there is going to be spent on things like, we managed to delay temporarily one settlement, But by the way, we've, you know, given in on the consulate, we've given in on the PLO mission, we've given in on all the other settlements. And by the way, we're not going to say a word publicly to defend the NGO sector, even though defending human rights organizations is part of the, what is supposed to be the core identity of this administration. It's hard to believe people are still holding out hope, but I mean, that's fine. You need to hold out hope, but pressure is going to matter. And I don't know what's going to be possible in the next 3 years, particularly as we come towards now, we're in election cycles. The other piece of it was the reality check is the discrediting this idea that the new Israeli government was going to be somehow changing everything. And as Fadi said, that isn't true. And for Americans, not just Jewish Americans, but Americans in general, who thought, well, the end of the Bibi era will be the beginning of a better relationship and this will become easy. You know, there's an irony to having the Minister of Diaspora Affairs wandering around the U.S. talking about the shared liberal values that Israel has with American progressives while Israel is literally clamping down on human rights and civil society organizations. You know, shared liberal values seems as being redefined to mean something that is not liberal at all and which runs counter to the values of most American progressives. To the extent that I would say that I think this year has had, you know, some positive notes. And I agree with Fadi very much on the apartheid piece of it, right? And this is something, you know, Peter, we had you on the podcast about this. You know, it's been fascinating watching the discourse change. And that discourse is still highly contested, but it has changed in ways that I think were unimaginable a year ago. At the same time, something that I think is, from my perspective, very positive, and maybe this is sort of technical for a lot of people, a lot of us have said for a long time that a key to a breakthrough in the narrative and the thinking around Israel-Palestine was to de-exceptionalize Israel and Israeli policy. And Israeli policy has been de-exceptionalized in some ways by things like NSO, right? When you have the world suddenly becoming incredibly concerned about surveillance, and any conversation about, you know, weaponized surveillance takes you back to Israel, and any conversation about Israeli weaponized surveillance takes you back to the Palestinians. And that's a clarifying moment for a lot of people. And I think it allows an entry point for people who didn't want to deal with Israel-Palestine to now do so or now be forced to do so. I think likewise, the debate around Ben and Jerry's, which, you know, it's still not clear to me whether, you know, this will be something that will move more people to be more open to boycotting settlements or even boycotting Israel. I have no idea, but it certainly brought it out in the open. And when you pair that with the recent news that ALEC is now using these anti-BDS laws as a model for clamping down on climate change or supporters of fighting climate change, for, you know, people who or companies who want to challenge the fossil fuel industry, which is, by the way, is something that a lot of us who work on lawfare have been warning would happen, right? But nobody cared. We were warning this in 2017, 2018. Well, it's happening now. And when ALEC gets involved and suddenly nationwide...
Maybe you should say what ALEC is, just for people who don't...
ALEC is the American Legislative, what's the E stand for?
Exchange
Council. Yeah. So this is an organization, a very conservative organization that involves legislators from across the 50 states that drafts a model legislation and then promotes it across all the states. Whether we're talking about things like climate change, they supported the anti-BDS legislation. They've supported stuff on reproductive rights. It's the sort of thing where you now have a national body with enormous weight behind legislation that is explicitly modeled on the anti-BDS bills. So for those of us who said, maybe you're someone who doesn't really give a crap about Palestinians and Palestinian rights and free speech when it comes to Palestine, but you know what? This issue cares about you and it's coming for your free speech. So maybe you should start caring. So I feel like that's a point of constructive hope going forward, that de-exceptionalizing of the conversation and an entry point for people to recognize that they're going to have to care about Palestine because, you know, the people who want to shut down all debate around Palestine, all, you know, the ones who want to delegitimize Palestinian rights and Palestinian narratives are also in the process happy to delegitimize rights and narratives on other issues. Fadi, turning to you, looking again domestically for you, do you want to talk a little bit more, and you can say no, about the domestic political situation for Palestinians. I mean, the loss of credibility for the PA, I don't think anyone would dispute that. The lack of a political horizon, which makes it hard to imagine how this PA or any subsequent or, you know, Palestinian leadership could actually build credibility right now under current constraints. What does that look like? What do Palestinians want when they talk about elections? And do you see a way forward that would enable a credible, empowered Palestinian leadership to emerge?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'd love to speak to that, but I also just want to build on the conversation you were both having a little bit before we move. And I think when discussing anti-Semitism and the political organizing, one thing kind of from a more Palestinian perspective that has dawned more and more, at least on people in my generation, is that our narrative as just what's going on with us, right? The fact that we're surrounded with cameras that literally flash red, yellow, or green based on facial recognition, that there's a whole system of surveillance, that we have had a woman who fought and almost went on hunger strike just for the right not to have to give birth in a prison. The narratives of, you know, people in Sheikh Jarrah in the middle of Jerusalem, surrounded by one of the most powerful armies in the world, you know, staying strong and standing in their homes. And two, basically, you know, early 20-year-olds just like kind of carrying a movement on their backs. All this narrative that there are people literally buried who've been buried, you know, mothers were holding on to the graves of their kids who were killed so that those graves wouldn't be raised by the Israeli military. Like all the stories and then the epicness of, you know, having 200 kids in prison by Israel right now and still everyday children going out in the face of tanks to throw stones. Like the power of this narrative, if we speak to it just factually, but also in depth, really carries a whole new generation of people. And that's what we saw in May, right? What we saw is more than at any other time, despite all these strategic efforts that I agree with Peter are just genius, like you have to give it to them. despite all these shrewd, very, you know, excellent efforts to kind of silence the Palestinian voice, that our voice and that narrative, at least for a glimmer, managed to break through. And then it was silenced. And it was silenced, you know, whether it was claims of anti-Semitism or whether it was, you know, this terrorist claim against Palestinian human rights organizations, which is also just like a crazy story. You have literally an organization defending children in prison and an organization collecting evidence of war crimes being tried and taken to global court by the war criminal who actually killed over 200 children and presided over 2,000 people killed. He's calling them terrorists and trying to take them to court, and he's going free. Like, the absurdity of it is unbelievable. But the reason I say this is because I think all these attacks, these claims of anti-Semitism, these claims of terrorism, what they're meant is actually to silence this narrative, the epicness of this tragedy. And oftentimes we can get pulled into, you know, kind of discussing these efforts, which, as you say, are academically bankrupt, and forget the powerful narrative underneath. And what we're learning in Palestine is actually maybe the way to defeat these efforts is not to go against them face to face and get into that argument, but to really amplify the true narrative underneath. And I think that's something we need to carry, because the truth is, yes, they can silence someone like Omari. But if Omari had a narrative that he was confident and he could go up and speak to, I'm defending these children and these people want children to stay in prison, it would just be much more powerful. And I think that's the game we need to learn how to play. But I just wanted to name that as like the polarities between what we're seeing and why those attacks are happening, at least to some level. But that said, just moving quickly then to the Palestinian context, because it's very similar, actually. So if we want to look at the power landscape, kind of these claims of, you know, anti-Semitism and terrorism, etc., being used to silence Palestinian voices in a kind of disinformative way or dishonest way, the PA uses the same types of narratives, claiming to be holding on to pursuing a two-state solution, or claiming that it is protecting a certain kind of international peace process to get money from the international community. And for many years, we're claiming that to the Palestinian people, this would get us across the threshold to freedom and liberty. And the big change that's happening, that happened in this year and that's moving forward, is the most recent poll shows that at 76% of Palestinians now want Mahmoud Abbas to resign completely. And if he ran in elections, even on against someone like Ismail Haniyeh, who's the head of the political head of Hamas at the moment, one of its main leaders, who's not really liked, he would still lose. And if he goes against Marwan Barghouti, he would lose by a full landslide. And at the other hand, what you're seeing locally on the Palestinian level, in almost every circle, basically different groups, civil society groups, have gone and spoken out and said, this is a dictatorship. Different groups within kind of, even Fatah, the leading political party, are breaking away from Mahmoud Abbas. We saw that with Nasser al-Qudwa, etc. And the only response that they've had is, of course, using more and more security forces to silence this. But where I think this is leading is two options. Either a showdown, where literally you get to a boiling point where there is a type of, hopefully more Tunisia-like, uprising and not something bloody, or where the PA is forced to have some form of elections at some point next year. The third option is, of course, that they go the Sisi route, which is just a complete obliteration. And this is important to note, because of the Biden administration's refusal at some level to really engage and push for elections, and because of its also funding to the PA, regardless of its policies, Mahmoud Abbas is having meetings asking, how can we monitor or shut down civil society organizations? The security forces are having meetings where they have lists of activists that they are thinking about, how do we arrest or silence these individuals? They've just funded a new surveillance cybersecurity force within the preventative security forces that's designed basically to monitor Palestinians on social media, survey them, and then spread kind of counter disinformation. So all of this is happening at this moment, and where it will lead in 2022, I guess that's the next chapter of the conversation, but I'll hand it back to both of you.
I'm laughing because in 2012, Khaled Al-Gindi and I wrote a piece entitled "Will Nonviolent Protests Spark a Palestinian Spring?" And we were really focused in that piece around the fact that compared to the rest of the region, Palestinians have a much harder spring to have, because Palestinians would have to have an uprising against two layers of authoritarianism, and that's much more challenging and a much heavier lift. I'm really struck by what you're saying there about the narrative and really empowering people with the narrative instead of challenging head on these false framings like anti-Semitism or the anti-Palestinian framing. I will say, for me, when I think about the challenge in the US, I've spent the past 6 years or so really steeped in the legal efforts, the lawfare. And I think that it's going to be really important for folks to keep their eye on the ball in the coming year, because as we get to midterm elections, I anticipate even more lawfare efforts when people are trying to score political points to show, look how pro-Israel I am. Look how much American free speech I'm willing to give up to prove that I'm pro-Israel. I think that's really going to be tough. I look at things like the passage this week of the bill in the House to fight Islamophobia. And I get a little bit of hope from that, because that was supported at the end of the day by all Democrats. I think it's incredibly depressing that not a single Republican could vote for it. But what I get hope from that is the extent to which that there was a very serious effort to turn that Islamophobia bill into an up or down vote on are you pro-Israel. And by and large, Democrats resisted that, which I think is really healthy. I will say that you have people like Gottheimer from New Jersey who played right into it and displayed their own, deep Islamophobic trope embrace. He had an amendment to the bill on the floor, which wasn't considered, but it was an amendment which basically suggests that you can't trust Muslims in government to not carry an anti-American, anti-Israeli agenda. You have to actually like put limits on what they're allowed to do while they're in government because you can't trust them, which is, you know, basic anti-Islamic trope that's been used against Muslims in public service for years. I worry about that. I worry about Ted Deutch calling Rashida Tlaib an anti-Semite on the House floor because she dared to use the word apartheid and talk about her family's experience. I think there's some real soul searching Dems need to be doing about this, because they clearly have not yet figured out how to deal with a shifting and more honest narrative around the Palestinian experience. And it's painful to watch. The other piece that worries me, and maybe I'm too far down in the weeds here, but you know, this is what I do here in Washington, is the you know, again, as we move toward in the Trump era, it's not post-Trump era, in the Trump era, and as we get towards midterm elections, the evangelical end times messianic element of this. We saw that on display this week when we had a far right-wing lunatic member of the House from my home state of Arizona, Paul Gosar, misrepresent a UN resolution on Jerusalem and use it as a hook to call for the removal of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is just so strikingly reckless and just inflammatory. But what's even more reckless and inflammatory, when you listen to the language he used, he's literally dog whistling to the end time folks. He's referencing scripture, and he's referencing scripture that talks about the abomination and desolation on the site where the temple must be rebuilt so you can have the second coming of Christ. That scares the crap out of me, I'll be honest. And I really worry that Dems, who by and large don't want to spend too much political capital on Israel-Palestine and defending Palestinian rights and free speech, I worry that their heads are in the sand when it comes to how bad this can get. And I think that's going to be tested next year. Okay, so we have time, I think, for one more round. Now, here's a round where we can have maybe two more rounds if you really want. I want to talk both really what you see in the next year, opportunities, and challenges. I've obviously talked about challenges already, so I won't talk about any of those. But you guys both can. Opportunities and challenges going into 2022. Fadi, I'm going to go to you first.
First of all, I think this is a good conversation, so I would vote for two rounds instead of one. even though that would probably not be enough. So I think the core opportunity here to bring things down to basics is that, you know, not to be divisive, but we do have two forces right now that are building up that I think Peter started well in describing, which is one force that is very value-based and kind of sees a world, but specifically in relation to this conflict, sees an opportunity to create, to move towards at least freedom, justice, and dignity, and that the individuals, regardless of their differences in that big circle under that big umbrella, are learning to build more power, whether that's through organizing on the ground in Palestine, whether that's through more collective action in the U.S., even at the level of congressional engagement, right? Laura, like just to speak to the work you're doing and others are doing, yes, Congress has, you know, had a lot of flaws, but we've also seen significant changes in the last few years in terms of how it engages with this issue. And that didn't happen randomly. That happened through hard work. So one of the key opportunities I see to build on in 2022 is how do we strengthen that orchestra where we're all playing different instruments, from the folks playing BDS to the folks organizing on the ground to the people engaging with Congress. How do we build that together into something that can take on the other side, which is also building power and becoming more creative and more ruthless? And I would put two lines under ruthless, because here in Palestine, it's become clear that whether it's the settlers or the Israeli military, that the level of openness to violence, and which has always existed, but is just becoming more and more. The best word to use, I think, honestly, is like lacks conscience. I don't, you know, it really kind of, there's no moral conscience behind the kind of level of things that are being done here. And I think at the same level, the game is getting dirtier in the US with these kind of claims of terrorism, etc., and how they're being underlined. So I just want to name that, you know, the opportunity is that actors that want a better future learn to work better together. And I think it can be a type of civil rights level, anti-apartheid level movement, you know, nothing less than that. I think we have the potential to begin building towards that in the next year and in the years to come at a scale probably not seen in history because of how deep this conflict goes. On the other side, the challenge is that for some people, that type of movement coalescing, coming together, is an existential threat, including to the Palestinian Authority, who want to maintain their stranglehold over this conflict and how to engage it. So it's not just the Israeli side, and they will do everything to silence it. And the other challenge that exists within this that I think we need to name is the tyranny of small differences that can break up this movement over things that really don't matter. I mean, it's, you know, we will have many differences between us as people who believe in freedom, justice, and dignity. The opportunity is to build the wisdom to solve those. But you can also see the kind of what I want to call kind of the cancel us culture, where we cancel each other from inside. And I think that's a big threat because it can be fed and amplified from bad actors to make us go against each other. And if we spend too much energy there, we lose. The last opportunity kind of for 2022 I want to name is that, you know, I want to call it the rise of new Palestinian leadership. I think, you know, regardless of all the things against us as Palestinians, whether it's the strength of the pro-Israel lobby, whether it's the U.S. policy, etc., our core weakness at the moment is the lack of a unified, visionary leadership that is capable of rising through this moment. And I believe there's an opportunity right now that will kind of come to the fore next year that can decide whether we do move in the direction of that visionary leadership or we get stuck with folks like Dahlan and Jibril Erjoub, et cetera, who will just keep us, you know, 6 feet under in terms of our cause. So those are some pieces. I'll stop there and hand over to Peter.
Yeah, there's so much there that's so important. I mean, I just want to underscore the last point. I mean, it seems to me that ultimately, I think in some ways, you know, what happens in the United States or around the world in general is going to be somewhat derivative. It's going to ultimately needs the power of the moral leadership and the vision and the struggle that happens on the ground. And I think that, you know, what you said at the end about visionary leadership, it's in some ways amazing that the movement has been able, for Palestinian rights, has been able to accomplish what it has been without that. I mean, if you think about the anti-apartheid movement, you know, from Desmond Tutu winning the Nobel Prize to, of course, the figure of Mandela kind of as the kind of animating figure that the ANC made a very conscious effort. Nobody knew, had met, you know, people hadn't talked to Mandela in decades. He'd been in prison, but they made an effort to build him up into this symbol. And it was able to work because they had a set of principles that he had laid out from the Freedom Charter decades earlier that people around the world could gravitate towards. And I think that, you know, you even see that in the absence of political leadership with people like, you know, Muhammad al-Kurd or all kinds of people, including you, Fadi, I mean, who create a kind of inspiration for people around the world. But it would be so much more powerful if you had political leaders who could offer that. I think that in terms of other things to look at, I mean, one of the things that I do think is interesting in the U.S. is when might we get to a moment where a Bernie Sanders comes out for one equal state? You know, could that, it seems to me that, you know, you gotta, you know, there's almost like a kind of a, it's like nobody wants to, politicians don't want to say that the emperor has no clothes, you know, because, but I think that at some point, I think when people break, there may be a breakthrough like that has been on the word apartheid. I think that would be really important. I mean, another big wild card, I think, just to put on the table is what happens if there's a regional war next year because the Iran nuclear deal collapses because this brinkmanship between, you know, Israel and Iran and the United States, where they basically try to basically keep the Iran nuclear program in check with all kinds of sabotage and military action, and the Iranians respond back and forth, that it spirals out of control and Hezbollah gets involved. And where does that leave us? I mean, it's a terrifying prospect. I have no idea, but I just think it's important that we're closer to that moment than we, I think, have been in quite a few years, because the deal seems probably like you can't Humpty Dumpty back together again. The other question, which I I don't know the answer to, but I just think one has to, I think I try to think about sometimes, and it's, again, it's very, it's not an optimistic thought, is we are in a moment, both in the United States, but also globally, where if you compare this moment to, let's say, the 1990s, let's say, or even the 2000s, the level of global systemic threats, pandemics, climate change, and of course, for us in America, the potential, a potential existential moment for American democracy, which we could very clearly be heading to in 2024. In a way, that just makes it all the more difficult, I think, to build a movement around this. I think it's not entirely coincidental that the anti-apartheid movement came to a successful fruition in the late 80s and early 1990s, when the Cold War was ending, and in a moment when in some ways it was easy, it was a moment of a third wave of democratization around the world, and also a moment where in some ways people could focus on this issue. We're now in this kind of almost apocalyptic moment where, and this is, I think, a huge challenge for people who want to organize around this issue in the United States. It's like, you know, young people in America, except for those who have a particular interest in this issue because of their background or they have some particular experience. I mean, you know, climate change kind of blocks out the sun, understandably, or the question of whether the U.S. democracy can survive the Republican Party, which is, and so I don't know, the intersection of those two questions, I think, also makes things more difficult. So those are just some of the things I think to be looking out for, because obviously 2020 could mean, as we've already, you know, 2020 could bring another, probably will bring more terrifying events, you know, both in terms of the future of American democracy and in terms of global existence on the planet vis-a-vis climate.
So I had a few notes I'd taken, and you guys both touched on things, just to sort of piggyback on that where you left it, Peter. For me, looking at 2022, and it's, we already had this in 2021, you know, we have a global erosion of liberal values, of democracy that has continued. And that certainly, to my mind, is it's fuel. It fuels the fire of what Israel is trying to do in terms of just, you know, erasure of the Palestinian cause, delegitimization of the Palestinian cause. That's a challenge. The opportunity there, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier, is the de-exceptionalization, where, you know, I still haven't heard FDD ever say, Foundation for Defense, Freedom House on FDD. I still haven't heard Freedom House ever say anything really about the Palestinians and the issues of Israeli democracy. It would be lovely if they would weigh in. The bottom line is, at this point, if you're talking about the erosion of democratic values and liberal values worldwide, and you're not talking about Israel, then it's clear that you're making an exception and you're a hypocrite. And that I think is something that strengthens those of us who are saying, if you care about this worldwide, you have to care about the Palestinians. So both challenge and an opportunity. Fadi, I want you to write an article entitled "The Tyranny of Small Differences," because I think that, you know, you have something to say here. It's one thing that I hadn't used that brilliant phrasing, but, and I'm really careful. I come to this with great humility. It's not up to me to say to Palestinians what are small differences. It is going to be enormously challenging. It already is challenging as we see a growing sort of grassroots and a base that maybe saw themselves as liberal supporters of Israel now increasingly dipping their toes into standing with Palestinian rights. And at the same time, many of them bring with them great fragility when it comes to concepts that cause them anguish, whether it's the word apartheid. I was recently on a call where a veteran Israeli peace leader basically went off at length about how the use of the word apartheid is the biggest problem today. And I'm like, are you kidding me? This is a call that took place right after the designation of the NGOs as terrorist organizations. I'm like, you're going to spend 10 minutes of our time explaining why using the word apartheid is the greatest threat to peace? But that's what he felt right in his gut. Again, there's also something that the whole idea of, and Peter had a podcast about this, I think today, the colonial versus, you know, colonial, post-colonial framing for understanding the Palestine conflict, which is now very much at the heart of the Palestinian thinking of the next generation, really previous generations as well, but the current generation of Palestinian thinkers who are really, I think, setting the narrative and doing so with great brilliance. That's very challenging for a lot of people who see themselves as allies. And I don't know how folks are going to navigate that. I see a great opportunity here to expand what it means to be in allyship with Palestinians. And I think that there is a reservoir of support that can be tapped into that wasn't there before, as people recognize that, you know, just reciting the Catechism of Two States simply is not going to keep doing it. But I don't know how you navigate those small differences. And I don't know how small those differences are. Small is in the eye of the beholder. I think that's a big problem. The last thing I'll mention for me is just it's a challenge, which is, again, I'm really stuck in the minutiae of the legal efforts. I think this NGO designation story has just started. I think that we are going to see, particularly as soon as we cross the 60-day threshold where the designations become, quote unquote, permanent under Israeli law. And I think we're going to see more designations coming in the near future, from what I'm being told by people on the ground. I think that is the first step. I think the next step is to start going after the partners and allies of Palestinian NGOs, whether they're Israeli or international, and the funders of those NGOs. I think that's inevitable. And folks who think that it's okay to stay silent about this, I think are not full. Again, if you say, well, I don't work on Israel-Palestine, this isn't my area. If you care about the civil society, human rights sector worldwide, you need to pay attention, because this is the camel's nose under the tent, to use a Middle Eastern metaphor. It is, I think, going to be used and weaponized in extremely dangerous ways. And people have to be ready to stand up and guard, not just guard against that, but fight back really hard. All right, so we are at 3:10 in DC time. That gives us. Let's do one quick last thoughts round. I'm gonna start, and then I'm gonna go to Peter and Fadi. You're gonna get the last word. So my last thoughts are: I am enormously dispirited when I think about this past year and what has gone on. And I appreciate this conversation because it reminds me that there actually are forces on the ground. There are currents that are actually energizing the next generation of Palestinian voices. And this is something the foundation has been really working hard, my foundation, to uplift and to elevate. And I think that if I'd say one thing on this call is a commitment, you know, on this podcast, a commitment on my part to do what I can to center and amplify those voices in 2022, because I think that is just critical. One of the reasons we are where we are today is because for the past decades, many decades, the Palestinians have not really been at the table and their voices have not been heard. And that is something that we are working really in a more serious way than ever to change. And I commit to keeping that going forward. I guess we're doing now the New Year's resolutions. There you go. Peter, you're up. Last thought.
I mean, I just want to go pick up on the point that Fadi, you made and you responded to about this, that's, you know, tyranny of small differences or cancel us culture. I think that, you know, part of the issue is that there's also an industry to blow these things up, right? So one of the things that we just see again and again and again and again is that pro-Palestinian activists, organizations, whatever, do something that gets labeled anti-Semitic. You know, I mean, it just happens constantly. And those conversations, you know, I have a piece coming out in Jewish Currents next week, which notes that, for instance, the Washington Post wrote two pieces about Sunrise DC's decision to not participate in a voting rights rally with Jewish Zionist groups, but didn't write a story about B'Tselem, Israel's most important human rights organization, calling Israel an apartheid state. So these issues, although they may seem various, and you know, they actually often get more attention than actually what's the crushing of people's freedom on the ground. I think that we have to continue to build a network of relationships and conversations that allow us to respond to these things. I don't need to tell either of you that it is talking about this issue is extremely treacherous, right? And it is very, very, very easy to say something that other people will then claim is anti-Semitic and try to use to, and then basically turn around to everyone else and say, well, that person needs to be disassociated from. It's also very, very important that we do recognize that, that anti-Semitism on the left does exist. It's not something people on the left are immune from. It's not something that Palestinian rights is immune from, no more than any group of people are immune from it, right? And so the challenge of kind of working together in order to make sure that we inoculate this movement for freedom and equality from anti-Semitism and also work to help people avoid putting themselves in a getting put in a situation where their message gets blotted out because they phrased something in a particular way. It pains me to think that people have to be so excruciating about this, but this is actually the situation in which we live. And if we need to get to a situation where the narrative and the stories that Fadi is talking about people's lives being destroyed and about a vision for freedom and equality takes center stage, and we don't get sidelined by these things, and we figure out how to deal with this whole infrastructure that is designed to do exactly that. And I think there's a lot of work that needs to take place in that regard.
Thank you. I'm just going to interject here that every movement has its assholes. That doesn't mean a movement is discredited. Absolutely. It's only this movement that is held to that standard. I'll also say, yeah, just my experience, I transcribed once a statement that Ilhan Omar made in the House Foreign Affairs Committee, where she was basically just attacked right and left for having made a virulently anti-Israel, anti-Semitic statement. And I actually transcribed the entire thing and put it on Twitter. It sounded like a statement from Peace Now. There was nothing in there. And the only thing, and not Wilf, came back at me on Twitter and said, I have the proof she's an anti-Semite because she talked about the need to protect the rights of both Israelis and Palestinians. And by using Israelis instead of Jews, that proves she's an anti-Semite because she's not recognizing the right of Jews to their own state. And I'm thinking, if I'm Ilhan Omar, I'm going to try to avoid using the word Jewish anytime because I know I'm going to get hit. So she used Israelis, and now she's still considered an anti-Semite.
I know, it's totally no win, but we still have to work at it.
Yeah. Okay, so Fadi, you get the last word. No pressure, it better be brilliant. It's always brilliant, so it's fine.
Exactly. It feels like a lot of pressure, especially because we touched on so many things.
And you're going to have to drop the mic. Do you have a mic that you can drop when you're done?
Yes, I'll do the Obama drop the mic gesture. So the first piece I just want to speak to, and I think this is at the core of the world we're living today that Peter touched on, which are the issues related to climate change, the existential threats that face us. You know, AI is a rising threat. People are facing just disasters left and right. There may be a war in the Middle East. Let's remember also the Middle East is pretty much at war with itself, if you look at places like Sudan, etc. And at the core, I think what Palestine-Israel is a microcosm of the kind of, you know, philosophical battles that we are facing in every corner of the world, including the battle in the U.S. for democracy. And what I mean by that is there are really kind of two schools today. And one school is a school that says we have more in common as humanity than that which divides us, and we need to fight to find what's in common and to build a better future for our children. And that comes first before anything else. And the other group says, this is my tribe, whether my tribe is Jewish or whether my tribe is Muslim or whether it's the evangelicals or whether it's the Republicans, and my tribe matters first. It's a kind of greedy, selfish angle that's going on. And within each of our movements, you know, it's kind of fractals, right? Within each of our movements, these battles repeat themselves again and again, where you have the individuals who want to move towards tribalism, dogmatism, because they believe it's right. We need to be fair. A lot of these individuals truly believe, the evangelicals truly believe that for humanity to actually be saved, you know, the Messiah needs to come back. And that's their religious belief. They believe it for good reasons, but again, it moves towards tribalism. And I think if we manage to succeed in this conflict in Palestine and shifting that paradigm and showing that the more in common value that we have supersedes all the little differences, then it will be transformational for the world. And that's the battle we're fighting. The challenge here that exists is within those battles, you have these power dynamics that exist, right? If you're a Jewish American, on so many levels, your voice matters more than a Palestinian. And at the same time, we are going against actors that will go to all ends possible, including the worst lies, to devastate those of us who have the loudest voices. And I'll say even to the example, and this is why we need to be so careful next year, but be willing to fight, because the battle is coming to each of our doorstep, whether we like it or not. I had the experience, and I didn't share this, but I'll share it with all of you. When I traveled to the U.S. in October to visit my father, who was sick, for the first time in my life, I was stopped by Homeland Security. And in Dallas Airport, they stopped me, they interrogated me. And a big, after the interrogation, what do you work? Have you been arrested? You know, et cetera, et cetera. The core question they asked me, you know, the last bit, because the lieutenant who was interrogating me really felt for me. And I also showed him my phone with like personal messages to senators, the members of Congress. I was like, whoever told you that I'm an evil person, you know, these senators wouldn't be messaging me if I actually was. He was like, listen, we got a report against you from an allied government claiming that you support terrorism. And, you know, we've been investigating you since May. Since May, he said, and I was surprised he shared this information. We've been investigating you. There's nothing on you. I'm going to let you go. But it was the moment you booked your ticket, it was like we had to, bring you in and interrogate you on this. And so just to kind of put two lines under what you said, Laura, which is these actors that want to silence the work that we're all doing, right? It's about all of us are going to go to that level and more. And I think we need to be prepared for it next year. But we also need to remember that the sacrifices we make are not just sacrifices for our own personal good. They literally will benefit all the other struggles that all the other groups we care about are going through. And so, you know, let's end with that and start 2022 with that belief that we're serving something much larger than ourselves.
You have been listening to Laura Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace, Palestinian activist Fadi Quran, and journalist Peter Beinart, reviewing 2021 through the Palestinian lens. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.